I don't have a quorum yet, but I will call the meeting to order. We can at least start talking about these bills. Let's see, Representative Tisi. We don't have quite a quorum, so we can't
do
things yet, but when we start talking about.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'll move that House File 922 be recommended passed. Oh, I'm sorry, I can't, we don't have a quorum.
All right.
Oh, now we do. Okay. I'll move that House File 2922 be recommended passed and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Tisi.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill relates to the MRF, the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund. You know, over the past several years, the legislature has made a lot of significant progress in reforming our pensions to make them more stable, to keep our promises. And Representative Murphy is going to have a bill here shortly that's going to make even more strides in that direction. This MRF fund is a fund of Minneapolis employees that work for the City of Minneapolis, but also the Minneapolis School District, the Metropolitan Council, the Metropolitan Airports Commission, Hennepin County. It's a variety of employers, in fact. It's not just the City of Minneapolis. About 4,900 Minnesotans are part of this and their spouses. Most are retired, and they live in nearly every legislative district in the state. The average benefit they get is about $2,700 per month, a lot less for widows. And significantly, it's the only benefit that they receive because MRF members do not get Social Security. So they're not, when they retire, they will not have access to Social Security. So it's the only retirement they get for many of them. And there's a sheet in your packets that I'd just like to draw your attention to. And at the bottom of it, you'll see 88% of the people on MRF. MRF is their primary source of income. It's also significant, I think, for us to note that these folks paid in a higher percentage of their salary than almost any other fund because they're not tied into Social Security. So what is the problem? The problem we're trying to solve, MRF is a closed fund. It has been since 1979, which means no new employees have come into the fund that were hired after 1979. And that was a legislative decision that was made back in 1979. So in a typical fund, if you think about it, the source of money for...
Yeah. If I might, I'm sorry to interrupt, but you referenced a document that said that, and I'm not sure that we have it. Can you hold it up?
Not in the packets. Perhaps it's not. It looks like, kind of like this. It's just a one-pager. All right, well, we'll get that copied and distributed. Thank you. So in a closed fund, in an open fund, like most of our state funds, the money comes from employer-employee contributions and from investment earnings. In a mature closed fund like this one, the only major source of earning is investment returns because there's obviously no employees paying into it because there are no active employees for the most part. There's just a handful. The investment returns for MRF has been in par with other funds in the SBI. It is now managed by the SBI. Before the market downturn, it was at 92% funding and on par or better than most of our funds. This is not a problem of mismanagement of investments. But this fund is caught in really an irreversible downward cycle. It has a life ahead of it of maybe 5 to 10 years before it will become unable to pay out retirement benefits. We can talk more about that if people have questions. But the problem is that the capital that you're paying out each year to pay benefits is more than the investment returns that you can get. You'd have to make approximately 19 to 20% per year in investment returns to be able to keep this fund whole. And as we all know, that hasn't happened and is unlikely to happen over the long term. For MRF, the Minnesota legislature has provided some additional source of funding over time. The state has provided a stream of funding. In fact, when this was closed, and this is an important point, the deal that was made was that the state was going to cover all unfunded liabilities starting in 1979. That was the contract, the deal that was made. Since then, the legislature has changed those rules, but I think in a court of law, there's going to, and this, if we don't solve this problem, this is going to end up in a lawsuit in a court of law, there's the contracts clause of our Constitution and the unfair impairment of contracts. I think that there's a very strong case to be made. Since the legislature struck this deal, since the legislature controls all the benefits that are paid out, the level of contributions that are coming in, and really all the rules that go around this MRF fund, this isn't controlled at the local level. We in the legislature set all the terms for these funds. Because of those two things, I think the state has a significant obligation to make up whether we fix it proactively, like we're proposing in this legislation, and less expensively, like we're proposing in this legislation, or whether we let it go to a lawsuit, or wait for 5 years, and then it becomes an incredibly expensive proposition to fix. So we set the benefit levels, we set the funding mechanism. In past years, about 55% of the money has come from the state of the excess that is needed, about 45% from local employers. So the solution that we're proposing here is a funding mechanism to cover outgoing benefits. There will be an administrative consolidation, so the fund will be administered by PARA in a separate fund. And one thing that's really important to note is that no PARA funds are going to be mingled with this fund. So the folks that are in PARA will not be having any of the money that they've contributed going to help this fund get solvent. And I think that's really significant for folks to understand. But the MRF board and its administration will disappear. Again, PARA and its beneficiaries will not be liable for making up any losses. The employers are going to be on the hook, so City of Minneapolis, the school district, and they've all agreed to be on the hook, MAC, the Met Council, on the hook for a share, their 45% share, which is kind of their historical share of the shortfall. And what we're asking for is the state to pick up the remaining share to make this fund whole. And that's
Chair.
What we're moving forward on.
And I will point out that the bill is written with blank appropriation. And we intend to move it on with a blank appropriation because this is a big enough number that has to be tied into everything that we're doing with the final
and
the budget and the final appropriations issue. But Representative
Kiffmeyer. Thank you for that explanation. That's very helpful. I think the fundamental thing here is the 45-55, mm-hmm. And I appreciate the explanation, the contractual obligations and some of that, but you used the last 5 years. How did it come to using the last 5 years? It seems like maybe the life of the, since 1979 or so forth, something like that, but
sure.
Why 5 years?
Yeah, and just to kind of put, and that's a good question, just to put in perspective, if in 1979 the excess appropriation would have been in place, the state would have been paying about a $66 million a year check. So we're asking actually for significantly less than that. We chose 5 years because that was kind of the most recent framework, and we usually measure our pension funds, kind of average them out over 5 years. That's kind of a typical pension thing to do. The percentages would change somewhat if we went to 10 years over the life of the fund. I think that's a discussion we need to have as a legislature going forward, and I'm open to having that discussion as we move forward.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it used to be 5 years, and that's part of the problem. What got us into some of these funding messes is because we did do those 5 years. But I, in general, but that is changing, has been changed, and is going to a different aiming towards a 20-year. I think there's kind of a phased-in approach, or maybe not. I'm not quite sure. But I do know that it is more than the 5 years. So,
well, Madam Chair, we do average out our the funding shifts over 5 years. We do have a 20-year or longer horizon for full funding, if that's what you're talking about, and that's been in place for a long time. Yeah.
Well, and also for Madam Chair, for accrual of benefits as well, but and paying out of benefits, not accruing of them, but paying them out. But I agree with you. I think that is an important thing when you're using that particular number that has a very long go-forward life. So it is something that needs to be carefully thought about.
Yeah, I think the other thing about the 5 years is this is, you know, as we're moving forward and people are trying to make adjustments to how they're going to fund this unfunded liability. And, you know, honestly, this legislature again set up the rules so that the money that should be coming in, whether it's from the city or from the state, hasn't been going in the way that it does for every single other fund. We created this trigger mechanism that is different than every other fund. That's a legislative decision. But the point I'm trying to make is that 5 years is kind of realistic in terms of how people have been dealing with this fund in terms of the obligations that the city and the state are going to have to come up with. And I think that's one of the reasons we chose the 5 years, because if you go back 30 years, you know, many things obviously have changed. And so in terms of planning going forward and what's realistic to ask of different entities, I think the 5 years is the most current and the most direct way to do that.
And one of the things that happened, actually, is that there was, first of all, there was this unlimited legislative appropriation. Then a cap was put on, and a cap of about $13 million. And then I think that cap was then cut down because there were good times and good investments process to $9 million. And I think that, you know, the legislature just backed out of its responsibility as they went on. And there, you know, I think the sharing with the city of Minneapolis is appropriate. One of the things that the city of Minneapolis did, which made me fully understand for the first time, I had always bought into all of the arguments of how that early retirement is such a good thing because you get expensive senior people go away and you bring in cheaper junior people. It turns out, and Merck was a prime example of it, the city of Minneapolis saves the money and the pension fund accrues the cost. So I now fully understand that, and I vote against every early retirement bill that stands around. But it took a long time for me to understand it, so I'm always not sure of how many other people understand it. But
anyway. Madam Chair, we won't keep up with you in any way, shape, or form. I'm always learning.
Representative Holder.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Thiessen. When you're looking at this demographic piece of the ages, et cetera, of the people in this plan, and then looking at the fiscal note, it talks about an annual cost to the general fund of $27.5 million through 2031. Given the ages of the majority of these people, why? I mean, at some point, this thing should peak and start to diminish as far as its outflow and went to the state. I mean, how is the state protected in that? Is there something in your bill that caps the percentage of the contribution of the shortfall so that if we have a great investment market and as the liabilities in this fund go down, that the commitment from the state also would go down?
Madam Chair, and I believe that the language in the bill actually makes the percentage allocation in the bill. And so that 27.5 is a percentage of the total amount that we're anticipating over the extended period of time to get it fully funded by 21, 30 years from now, right, or in the extended. So if in fact, the stock market performed well and the needs were less, you know, that percentage could decrease.
But, Madam Chair, shouldn't there also be a built-in reduction of need due to the, what would you would assume, the death of some of these people as they move along through life?
And, Madam Chair, I would imagine the way we do pensions that they are anticipating that people are going to die. Maybe Luther can address that.
I don't think we have any cases yet of any who have not, so it's an actuarial thing and a reality, but
yes. Please identify yourself.
Madam Chair, I'm Executive Director of MRF. The way this thing
just
will...
Just say who you are for the
Luther
table.
Thompson. The way this works is that there's a 2031 amortization date. If you get the additional money that's in here, the state's portion is fixed until that date. The actuarial assumption is it'll be fully funded by that date, and the state's contributions will then go away. Certainly, there will be people and beneficiaries living for the next 50 years, but there will be sufficient money in there, if all of the actuarial assumptions hold true, that there will be sufficient money to pay for those retirement benefits. If the market goes down, the entire risk of a downside market falls on the employers. So if you have another severe downturn, the state's portion is fixed, and anything additional would have to be borne by the employers.
But, Madam Chair, what happens if the market does great? Then why won't the state's contribution go down?
Madam Chair, Representative, if the state wanted to participate in the risk of the market, you could put in here a proportional share. I think what the state is trying to do is eliminate the downside risk. Now, the good news is if the market improves, it'll get fully funded sooner, and the state's proportion will go down.
And that's built into
Right, that's built in.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe a question for staff. Just reading the bill, could somebody point out where the placeholders are? I still am just seeing numbers here as compared to placeholders.
Madam Chair and Representative Downey, you're correct. On page 35, there are actually specific numbers in the language of the bill. You'll see the existing $9 million on line 35.26 that we currently carry in the state government bill, and then the additional 27.5 of that.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I'd just point out also, I think on page 25, the numbers are also hard-coded in here, so I'm guessing we need an amendment of some kind to move it forward with placeholders as compared to, and maybe staff can think about that. If I could, Madam Chair, I have a couple questions, too.
Okay, let's... You know,
do you want to amend
I guess I considered $27 million was kind of a placeholder, but I'm perfectly happy to. I'd always been thinking of it as a blank, so we'll just get that. Thank you.
And then, if I could, Madam Chair.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Thiessen, I'm not sure if you can answer this or if this is maybe the board or somebody else from MRF. I'm looking at the actuarial assumptions, and a lot of this has to do with presumed increases in wages and other interest assumptions. And I had my finger in the pages. It's page 28. There's some interest rate assumptions, and there's various tables on page 30, et cetera. And I am not an actuary, and I don't really understand the mechanics of pensions. But these assumptions look really high to me. So maybe somebody could just explain, at least at a layperson's level, how these actuarial tables fit in and how reliable they might be given current economic conditions.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Downey, those are the para assumptions that we use for our para fund. So we're not we're just adopting those assumptions that we use for our state funds. Now, you may have a point generally, but that's where those come from. And I think you may want to address that to Representative Murphy when she presents her bill of affair. But that's what it is.
Madam Chair, these would be outstanding interest rates for most of us.
No, that's...
And Madam Chair, could I ask, is the board, would the board, I'd be interested to hear from the board in terms of their opinion of this proposal, the strategy, the underlying actuarial assumptions, just to get their opinion on the kind of the fundamentals that we're basing this legislation on.
Madam Chair, which board?
Board of Pensions, the investment folks.
We have the PARA board, and then we have the State Board of Investment. And
SBI is what I was thinking.
Okay. I don't know if they're here.
Can I just ask a quick question to Representative Thiessen? Thank you, Madam Chair. This has to do with a question that Representative Downey just asked. This hopefully just a quick answer. I'm trying to understand what you talked a lot about this being the state and the legislature did this, and presumably the city of Minneapolis did something since these are Minneapolis employees. So presumably they entered into these agreements. And I'm wondering if there's, since the state has a defined dollar amount, I'm wondering if what the dollar amount is that the city of Minneapolis, what their contribution to getting us out of this horrible mess is going to be, where I might find that language.
Right. First off, Madam Chair and Representative Pepin, in fact, it is the state that set all the rules for this. The city of Minneapolis did not enter into these agreements. We set the rules for what all the assumptions are. The legislature does. We set the rule. You're looking skeptical, but that's the case.
Well,
and then the city share, and I don't know the exact percentage of the employers are dividing up the other 45%, so whatever, that would be about $23 million, and the city share is the biggest portion of that, I think about 13 or 14 million additional dollars. 20 million.
That's in here?
Would be the city. I don't know if that's in here, but that's the percent, because because, as Mr. Thompson explained, we are setting the state share at a fixed amount and the city share, and that's, you know, under current rules, that are current, kind of currently, that would be about 45-55%. So 45% for the employers, the city, the school district, and 55% for the state. If the assumptions don't hold up, so if the market has another downturn, the city share would actually grow. So we're not, I think the way it's set up, but we're not putting a fixed amount in there because the risk of a downturn market is on the employers and not on the state. And so I think that's why it was designed that way.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, I think I would feel a lot more comfortable if there was at least a floor amount, because to me it seems like there should be, we should lock in some type of a contribution from the city so as to ensure that they are paying their portion of it as well as we are. And I understand what you're saying, that, you know, we don't know exactly what the numbers are going to be, but to me, we should look at putting at least a floor in, as opposed to, I mean, we're making the state, we're locking the taxpayers of Minnesota down, most of whom had nothing to do with any of this, right? The city of Duluth didn't do this.
Except their representatives, but. So, Madam Chair, what I'd ask is that we actually defer that question so Mr. Thompson can address it, because I think you might get a better answer from him, and then let Representative Downey's question be answered, and then we'll come back to that, if that's okay.
Unfortunately, I have to leave for 15 minutes, but I will be back.
Okay. Please identify who you are.
My name is Jim Heidelberg. I'm manager of public programs for the State Board of Investment. What was your specific question, Madam Chair, Representative?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I wanted your perspective on the underlying assumptions that are built into the financial model, and again, as a layperson, not a professional in the actuarial or pension arena, just give us some sense whether or not what's in this bill seems reasonable given the fundamentals of the economy and the markets out there.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think you're asking the question basically, what is the reasonableness of the 8.5% interest rate assumption? Is how I understand the question. The 8.5% assumption has been used. It's been since 1997. One of the retirement systems could verify that for me. But if we look back, the State Board of Investment pension investment history, we have returned about 9.5% over a 25-year period. It's not to suggest that going forward we're going to get 9.5%, but what I'm saying is that over time we have accomplished that number, and we have a program in place that we're confident is appropriate for moving forward.
Okay. I think that's the question. Thank you.
Sorry.
Okay.
So to address Representative Pepin's question, if the members want, there is no floor put into this legislation because, again, of the downside risk. You know, it would be possible, I suppose, to put in some kind of a floor so we get to full funding even faster. I mean, the reality is if the state's contribution, if the market returns are bad, the city and the employers are bearing the share. If the market returns are good, we are going to get to full funding more quickly, which means the state obligation goes away at that point. And so in some sense, it's built in both ways, but if people are interested, we can have a discussion about putting in an actual dollar amount floor, too.
Madam Chair?
Representative
Kale. I confess that, like Representative Downey, I know very little about pensions, but I wonder, Representative Thiessen, if it's fair to say that there is, in essence, a floor by formula, not by dollar amount, that there's a proportionate commitment by the City of Minneapolis that's in the bill, and so we're not sort of saying the state's taking over X dollar amount. It's the state is making this commitment, and the city has to make the proportionate commitment according to the.
Right. I think that would, Madam Chair, Representative Kale, I think that would be a way of saying it. I do think that we can have a further discussion, though, because if the market performs really well, that proportionate share is going to, you know, arguably shrink because the funding each time is going to be a little less. So, but it would pay off, you know, more quickly. So it's a discussion we can have, and I'd be open to having that. I do want to make sure that members understand also that in this bill, the retirees are putting in money themselves. They are taking a significant cost of living increase reduction and we'll hear more about it, Representative Murphy's bill, which PEAR is actually getting a significant reduction as well, but they're joining into that. So the employees are actually putting a lot of money on the table to help pay for this proposal. The retirees.
Okay, Representative Polberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Thiessen, on page 40, it looks like you're taking somebody or some group out of the open meeting law, and then also, I don't know if you're lowering somebody's salary, or can you talk about sections 3 and 4 on page 40?
Madam Chair, I believe we're probably taking MRF out of the open meeting law because they're going to disappear. 422A is MRF. So because they're going away, they won't. That makes sense. And what's your other question? And the compensation limit is the same issue. Because this is just these two changes are just because MRF is not an entity anymore, so we don't need to have in statute references to that entity.
And when does MRF fail to exist any longer?
As soon as the bill passes, essentially.
On that very day?
June 30th. And I think the effective date, though, is the June 30th for all these provisions.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay, we're going to take the. We have the amendment to take the 27.
Madam Chair, members, and I'd ask Mr. Thompson, Representative Thiessen, and Mr. Martin if I'm missing something, but I think if you wanted to have blanks, it may be appropriate to put them in three places. On page 25, lines 20 and 33, to delete $36,500,000 and insert blanks. And then on page 35, line 28, delete $27,500,000 and insert a blank. I have that written down.
And I think that puts it into the context of the total budget discussion for the end of the session. Representative Ben.
I think I don't know. Did you need to do anything?
No, we'll just move it. I'll just move that. Any discussion of that amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay, Representative Ben.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I.
You could have moved this one.
Pardon me?
Oh. That's all right.
So I appreciate the bill coming forward, and maybe in the grand scheme, the panoply of all of the pension funds that are underwater that are looking to the state to bail them out, this is probably a unique circumstance in terms of the state's role in dictating the position that it's in, or dictating the policies that put it in this position. So, I'm glad you're bringing it forward, and this is something where we absolutely need to honor these retirees, the commitments we've made to these retirees. It does seem to me like leaving these as placeholder numbers and figuring out these ratios, maybe finding some way to put in some comfort language so that there's the fairness and the state's role moving forward is commensurate with the employer's roles, that would be something good. And so maybe my question, Madam Chair, is where does this go from here? Is this just straight to finance?
It's finance,
or is there,
and then it goes to Ways and Means. It's also in Representative Murphy's bill.
So, Madam Chair, maybe the question for Representative Thiessen, is there an opportunity kind of between now and...
Oh, yeah.
Okay, we've got plenty of places to go into the register or anything. Okay,
By now, I think all these bills end up going to rules, too, don't they, I think? Or no?
No.
Because it's a money bill. I don't know.
Pension. Good. Okay.
Madam Chair, just to respond on the record, absolutely, and I think some actually good points were raised here today, and on the money issue, that's going to, again, be part of our larger end-of-session discussion. I would say, though, that we have had discussions, with not just the House but the Senate and with the administration about this issue, so that discussion has already been engaged.
Okay. So I'll then renew my motion that has style 29. 22, we recommended to pass and move on to finance as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you.
Thank you. Really, please.
Representative Murphy. Representative Murphy. Now, I know these are very big, fat bills with lots of stuff in them.
Chair, you advised, gave me good advice earlier in the morning, and I am ready to comply with your advice.
Representative Murphy. Yes. Then, we're starting with 3281?
Yes.
Okay. House File 3281, recommended that it pass and go on to finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This bill
is the omnibus pension bill made up of over 24 individual bills and documents that the Pension Commission heard and pondered from last year, 2009, over the summer and in every month over the summer and in more meetings than that since January. And most of the bills that we heard, if there were any problems, were worked out and people were quite happy with the accommodations that we made. Article 1 of this bill is the financial sustainability bill that will provide stability for the public employees' plans that have resulted in lower returns than were anticipated at the time that the state made their initial investments and commitments to what the state was going to invest. And because of that and because of the downturn of the national economy and the slow rise to get back on our feet, we are making shared sacrifices with employees, retirees, and employers. And we're suggesting how that's done. Article 2 through 16 are mostly standard housekeeping, technical type of changes that came before the commission. Article 1 in itself is, as I said, are the substantial changes that we must do in order to keep our contract with the state and county and city employees across the state. And we are increasing employee contributions, and we are increasing employer contributions, and we are recouping much savings. Starting with the Minnesota state retirement systems plans, they have already started their phased-in increases for employee contributions and employer contributions. And so that is already set into the law, except for the state patrols plan. And in the state patrols plan, we are planning on having a savings of $6 million and an increase of $1.2 million on employee contributions and $1.8 million on employer contributions. And that, when that left the last committee, the government op committee, we did not have those numbers. And that has been worked out between the MSRS and I believe it was the Department of Revenue, and they have received commitment for that additional funding. So we will have it for the Minnesota State Retirement Systems. We have about $52.8 million savings, and we will have an increase in $1.2 million in employee contributions and $1.8 million of employer contributions for the time period that is in the language of the bill. For the Teachers Retirement Association, the contribution increases will be phased in over 4 years, $21.5 million per year, and by 2015, the contribution rates are projected to be $98 million per year. There will be a savings of $135 million for the TRA, and employee contributions will go up, as I said, $21.5 million per year, and employer contributions will be matched at $21.5 million. And for the PERA Association, there will be a savings of totally of $235 million, and employee contributions will go up $14.4 million, and the employer contributions will go up $15.2 million.
Okay. Ms. Oswaga has asked to testify on the TRA portion of the bill. And so, briefly, this is, you know, the place that we really work this out on is in the Pension Commission, as you well know. So,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota. And I'll try to keep my comments, as requested, fairly brief. I just want to clarify to make sure that people know that Education Minnesota continues to be opposed to the TRA provisions in this bill. And we believe that while we've heard it's a shared sacrifice, we believe that the sacrifice is a bigger burden on the active members. And those are the people who do not have the benefits of those that currently have the rule of 90 and so on. And I'll just illustrate this by giving you some historical perspective. I've used a couple of documents at the very beginning of the handout that were produced by the Teacher Retirement Association. And while we have worked hand-in-hand with TRA and greatly respect all of the work they have done in the past, we just don't agree on this solution. If you take a look at TRA contributions over the last, you know, I guess 30 years, since 1980, the employer contributions have been much higher. It wasn't until 1997 that the employer contributions were reduced. And why were they reduced? They were reduced because the fund was doing very well. And the employee contribution actually went up. The reason that happened, as I said, is because the fund was doing well. If you go to the second page, I'll come back to the first one again, but if you go to the second handout, you can see the historical contribution rates. And at the bottom of the first page, in 1997, you'll see that at that point we reached 101.3 sufficiency. So a decision was made by the state to reduce the employer contribution. Now, you can see that in various times when the fund was not doing as well, the state would kick in money. I want you to think about your own personal situation. If you have a 403B or a 401K, and your employer contributes to it, your employer has said, I'm going to contribute to it. And when your 401K or your 403B starts doing really well, your employer says, okay, well, we're going to reduce the amount that we're contributing to you because your fund is doing pretty well. Well, you don't do that, and the reason you don't do that is because you put your money in for investments for the up and the down times. But because we have a defined benefit, it was thought, you know, that we'll reduce the employer contributions, and if bad times, we'll increase them. So that's one of the concerns that we have. The other concern is that in TRA's own document, their PowerPoint, it says that 75% of the unfunded liability is due to the post fund. 25% is the downturn of the market. So if you looked at that, then one could argue, and we would argue, that maybe 25% is a portion that should be really shared between the employer and the active employees. These are the individuals who are actively teaching. You may have, you know, you've heard in the past about some retirees getting big benefits, and that is one of the reasons why we have a deficiency in the post fund now. What we're doing with this bill and why we are opposed to it is because we're asking the active members to pay 2% increased contribution for a problem that they had very little to do with. Because, as I said, TRA's own numbers said 75% on their PowerPoint that they produced was unfunded liability from the post fund. So they would be paying 2% more with no pension benefit improvement. One can also argue that they have been paying for the rule of 90 for the individuals who have already received that. And then I certainly would have a lot more to say, but in the interest of time, I'll just summarize by just doing a little education piece. Take a look at this document. This was done in October 2006, and it compared Minnesota teachers with other teachers around the rest of the country. We can only compare ourselves to, there's 34 states that have teacher pension plans coordinated with Social Security. And it's good to be at the top of all of these, and the gray areas is where we're at. There's multiple columns, and then we put the gray area where Minnesota is. And the normal retirement age, The front side is the side that has only one gray area. And so by looking at it, you can see we're near the bottom in almost every pension benefit calculation that is there. The normal retirement age, we're tied for last place. Employee contributions, we are above average. Employer contributions in the state of Minnesota, we're near the bottom or at the bottom. Final average salary, we're tied for last place. Formula multiplier actually would move up a little bit because we went to 1.9. Pension calculation after 30 years, we're near at the bottom. Taxation of benefits, we're at the very bottom. So our point is we want to be part of the solution. We want to fix this inequity problem. We want to fix the stability of the fund. That is a priority as well. We think that this burden is on the employees. And then one last thing, take a look at that first page that I gave you. When you look at the green bar graphs, the vertical bar graphs, if you look at the 34 states that I talked about, and this is, again, TRA's document, the employees in other states are paying an average of 5%. We're now at 5.5. We would end up being at 7.5. In the employers around the country, their average is 8.6%. Minnesota's at 5.5%. So we think this burden is really a shift to the employee, the actives who had little to do with this problem and do not have the pension benefit that we think that they should have. Again, we want to be part of the solution. We don't want to be a total blocker, even though that is what everybody says. We want to be part of the solution.
Representative Bing.
Thank you. First, Representative Murphy, thank you for carrying this. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work just carrying the actual bill around. I
actually take a certain amount of credit for this because I was the first person when I chaired government operations 100 years ago for the first time. I decided that we would have an omnibus pension bill instead of 50 separate individual pension bills, each of which would be discussed individually on the House floor. Mm. It was a fight with the Senate that we won.
100 years ago, and you still play hockey. Yeah.
it seems like 100 years ago.
She started copying on two sides of the paper.
Nice. Look at that long-term vision. Ms. Allswager, the question I have And you know, maybe I just haven't had enough experience in pension, you know, but isn't what we do now going to affect your current members later? And being, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but if the people that are paying in now, if we pass this, and I'm assuming we're going to pass it, it's gonna help them when they become Representative Kahn's age to retire.
Most of them retire.
She has no more bills after this session.
Good point.
Madam Chair, Representative Bigham, certainly putting in money earlier is a good idea and is beneficial. And we would actually argue a couple of years ago when we've been trying to do this, that would have been the time to do it. We wouldn't be here today like we are today had we had the TRA and Education Minnesota benefit reform proposal. That was the thing to do then. Okay. But we can't now. Or we can. We would like to. And that's why Education Minnesota proposed a 3-3 in the Pension Commission. Having our active members pay 3% more, 3% more, and pay 100% for the pension benefit equity, and 1%, so that's 2% basically, and then 1% for the stability, and then 3% for the employer. Still, it works out pretty much exactly the same. We're willing to do that. We're willing to go from 5.5 to 8.5 to pay for a pension benefit equity. We are part of the solution. We are not blocking everything, as you hear in the papers and everywhere else. We want to fix this thing.
Okay.
I'm fine. Okay. I just wanted to point
that out. I noticed Mr. Kite from MSBA is looking anxious and wants to say a few words, I assume. And then we'll let Representative Murphy finish.
Madam Chair, just this, I think you have the answer to this. Ms. Allswager talked about an equity thing that's of the 3-3. Does that then include the rule of 90 for everyone? Is that part of what that package proposal was? I mean, you don't go to 3-3 without getting something for it. So is that that what it is? It's the rule of 90 for everybody? Is that what you're calling the equity piece?
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, absolutely. But it isn't a rule of 90. We decided to back away from that because we thought that politically it wasn't going to happen. What we decided to put forward was an increase in the formula multiplier and not an age, not where you could retire at age 57, 58, like with the rule of 90. It would be an age 62 normal retirement age. And you would get credit for the years that you work. So you wouldn't have just an automatic rule of 90 formula and you could go. We just thought it was fair for everybody, especially for those individuals who might not ever make the rule of 90, moms who stayed home or dads who stayed home to take care of the kids, people who were in the military, you name it. We just thought it was a much more rational and more with the times kind of approach. And if anybody wants to help us get that done, and we'll pay for 100% of the benefit, we're here to do it. We're here to do it all.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Kite.
Good morning. I'm Charlie Kite. I represent the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, and we're the association of all the school superintendents in the state. I want to speak just briefly to say we support the bill as it is presented right now. We're realists. We think this bill, as it's presented right now, has a chance of working its way through your processes and also being signed by the governor. We do respectfully disagree with Education Minnesota on what they were presenting. We feel that we need to be looking forward. We can all spend a lot of time looking back and say, well, there's a mistake back then for this way or that way. You can't turn back the clock. We have to look forward from where we are today. We feel that we have to stabilize these pension funds first and get that done. And what the bill right now proposes is that employers, employees, and retirees all carry a portion of that burden to get it done. Arguably, this is going to be an expense to the employers at a time when we're under a lot of stress. But the superintendents have looked at this issue very carefully. They feel that it is important to get the stabilization done now. You have not only an obligation to the folks that are later in their career, but the folks early in their career who are paying in substantial amounts of money on the hope and the promise that there will be a pension for them someday. So we need to get this done. We think that there's a consequence to delaying. If you wait longer, the problem is going to be larger, and in fact, the solution starts to be one of reducing the benefits for active employees, and we don't think that should happen. So we speak in support of this bill as it's presented and hope that it can move forward through this committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And you'd rather be bicycling than here. Okay. Representative Murphy. Oh, we do have to... We need one amendment.
We have an amendment on the state patrol plan.
Okay, well, let me do the one really simple amendment, which is the same amendment that we put in the MRF bill, which is to take out the definitive numbers. So that was the same amendment that we put on the MRF bill, since the MRF bill is part of this. I'll move that. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment is... Do you have it in your packet?
No.
The amendment is 32815A. And it's primarily the language that makes the State Patrol agreement fit with the bill.
Okay, I'll move the 5A amendment. Is there anything else that we need to know about it? Why has this come at this point instead of through the
committee? Because, as I spoke before, they were negotiating and coming to the agreement.
Okay.
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the State Retirement System. In the bill that you have, we had increasing the employer contribution by 11.2%. Lowering the cost of living adjustment for retirees to 2% and a modest employee contribution rate increase. I did meet with the various agencies or discuss this with the agencies, and they felt that that cost was too much of a burden. So what we are doing in this amendment is we are reducing the cost of living adjustment from the current law of 2.5% down to 1.5%, increasing employee contributions by 2%, and increasing employer contributions by 3%. So the employer cost went down from $8 million to under $2 million per year. So it was just something that we unfortunately couldn't get pieced together prior to the Pension Commission.
Any questions on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes.
Madam Chair, there's another amendment, a technical amendment from the Revisor's Office. It deletes a sunset date and makes a continuous program and on early retirement incentives. We have very, very limited early retirement incentives in here. But what we do, the agencies can offer an early retirement incentive that primarily for middle management people. And I'm told that the governor's office is very interested in seeing that this language passes.
That's right. Okay. Representative Colbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Murphy, why do we have a retro active effective date on line 7 and 8 of your amendment?
Because it was supposed to, we'll go back to the time that the sunset started. We'll go back to before that.
We put a sunset in, and we want to take out the sunset. And so what we have to do is we have to go back to when the sunset went in.
And so it can be a continuous program.
Then, Madam Chair, if that's the case, then why are the dates different?
Expired on 2009. It expired in 2009.
It's expired. We're taking out July 15th, 2009, and we're putting in July 2nd, 2009.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm Lawrence Martin from the Pension Commission staff. This was the suggestion of the revisor statutes. I am not sure why they picked July 2nd of 2009, unless that was the date that in 2009 that the bill was presented to the governor.
But that
the prior piece of legislation. I'm sorry, there is not a good answer that I have.
And so there was a perfectly good number.
Oddities of the legislature. There must be a reason
from
that nobody knows.
Madam Chair, Representative Hobart, from the revisor's office.
Yes. We do whatever they tell us. Okay.
Okay.
I'll move the 810 amendment, or whatever it is. All those in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay. Now, is this bill ready?
I believe it is. And any last comments? I would like to remind you that Article 12 and 13 is the bill that we heard from Representative Thiessen.
Okay. So I'll move that the bill, whatever this one is, House File 3281, as amended, be recommended to pass and go on to the finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay.
Now, Chair, that bill is just Article 1.
Okay.
Of 3281.
Do we want to do that separately? Is there any reason to do that separately now?
Ms. Martin.
Is there any?
Are they still traveling separately in the Senate? They are traveling separately in the Senate.
Okay, so I'll move that House File 2952 recommended to pass and move on to finance. Did we put any amendments in that Article 1?
Yes, okay. Madam Chair, you need to do the same amendment that you did for the State Patrol to this bill,
okay,
as you did for the omnibus bill. There also is a technical amendment to make this match up with the omnibus bill as it came out of House Criminal Operations.
Okay. Can I just do a motion that says that this bill will be amended to be identical to Article 1 in the... Is that... What? Okay.
We have all the language. Right. The effect of what you would suggest would be a delete everything from Article 1.
Okay, okay.
I would not save paper. Effects.
Okay. Are both of these amendments together, or is it one?
Madam Chair, this is the State Patrol only.
Okay.
Change, and I have
okay,
the other amendment also.
State Patrol change. All those in favor of that amendment to this bill, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Now the other one is the technical.
Yes.
Representative Holbrook can ask again. It's different. No, this isn't. No, the dates are different in this one. Sorry.
Madam Chair, this has to do with the deferred annuities augmentation portion of Article 1. It was amended in the omnibus bill. The sustainability portion of the bill was amended in the Governmental Operations Committee, but this change was not made in the conforming bill, the separate traveling bill. So this merely matches up, causes the financial sustainability bill to match the omnibus bill.
Okay. I'll move
as it came to you.
The 4A amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay. Is that bill ready?
Barring other suggestions from other parties.
That's okay. All you need to I'll now move that House File 2952 be recommended to pass as amended and go on to the finance, full finance. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate your work.
Madam Chair, if I might, just on that last bill, did we change the money amounts to blanks? Or do we need
this
to?
One,
we don't need to do that.
Madam Chair, the MRF proposal is not in the financial sustainability bill, so it's not needed to remain here.
So we did change it in the other bill.
We changed it in two of the three bills.
Okay. I think a lot of people clear out once you finish, so we'll let them all clear out before we move on to the next one.
That was fun, huh?
Tell Mary Liz when we pass on next bill, you'll get on the pension.
What's that?
Look, one of the things we always do, I usually put it on this bill, but I've decided to change, I'll put it on the our next bill, which is the House always wants to increase the membership of the pension commission and add another minority member. This is only one. And so the House always passes it and the Senate always turns it down. So we'll try again. In a different format instead of the pension bill. Okay, Representative Bunn. This is House File 2839. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Senate File 2758. Okay, and the summary. We also have the delete everything amendment. Okay, Representative Bunn, do you want to explain your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I'm sniffling not because my feelings are hurt because everyone left the room, but because I've got allergies this morning. Madam Chair and members, this bill is a bill that's part of a package of legislation moving forward this session that came as a result of discussions in the Small Business Caucus, a bipartisan member group of House members that met over the interim to discuss barriers to the expansion and site.
I guess I'll move that Senate File 2758 be recommended to pass and go back to finance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to help promote further access, this particular bill, the goal is to help for further access and better access to information by potential entrepreneurs and existing small businesses to all public and private resources available to them for technical assistance, grants, and other kinds of helpful information in the state. Currently, we have a number of resources available through the state and through private-public partnerships in this area, including some excellent publications and some online resources and licensing directories and those kinds of things. We learned during these discussions and testimony and the Small Business Caucus, though, that relative to some of the best practice standards in other states, that Minnesota has fallen behind and has a ways to go to be as effective as these other states. In particular, there are some states that are as far along as having a one-stop shop for all small businesses or potential small businesses that offers information online, both about information and resources, but also that they can actually apply for their permits and their licenses online over the Internet. These capabilities do not currently exist at this level in our state, and they certainly don't exist through one location. on the aspect having to do just with resource information, not the licensing and permitting, the state has over the last couple years, through a private-public partnership with the chamber, with private funding, developed an excellent resource called the Business Connection that is currently in existence. Again, though, this only goes part way. The way that the interface with it, with the individual contacts the site, is not as sophisticated as what exists in other states and doesn't necessarily, in the most effective way, lead individuals to the resources they're looking for, although it's quite good. The agency, in particular, the head of this Office of Entrepreneurship and Small Business Development, Mike Myrie, in our conversations with us, identified a better way to do this, a more sophisticated way to do this, to take us into the future. This legislation was designed to do that. Because of fiscal challenges, we are encouraging through this legislation that the commissioner, we are directing him to go seek additional private funding to take this website, this web-based mechanism, to the next level. That's what this bill does. There are still ways to go beyond that, so it's just a first step. The amount of money involved to go full-blown, one-stop, including all the licensing and permitting one time, was millions of dollars not yet available to the state. When this bill came to, the bill is already passed in the Senate, as you know, because we're working in the Senate file. When it came to the House Finance Committee, a number of interesting issues and good points were made during that discussion. And the delete all amendment before you addresses all three of the core issues we discussed in that hearing. Not in order of importance, but it's going to take them one at a time. First of all, it was raised that this did not, the legislation as written, didn't refer to a particular area of statute. That was a staff decision, partly because a portion of it is kind of a temporary thing in terms of them seeking the funding, but other portions of the bill are really asking them to long-term support and sustain this platform and this virtual network. So we've reconstructed the legislation to actually put it in statute, which is indicated in line 1.3, to make that clear and separate out the reporting section to address that issue that was raised during finance. Secondly, another issue that was raised is the way that the Senate language had been drafted. It came across as if it was a mandate that the commissioner must develop this new platform, this more sophisticated portal, whether or not they actually obtained the private funding. We have redrafted the language, which you'll see in the first few lines in 1.5 through 1.8, to make it what we are requiring them to do is seek the funding to develop the site, not to do the site necessarily, that they have to go out and seek. So we didn't want to put a mandate on that possibly they wouldn't acquire the funding for, but they, and we are very hopeful that they will. And finally, most importantly, we have this great discussion brought up by Chair Kahn and a co-author on the bill about the importance of not having proliferation of new websites by the state or through private-public partnerships that don't meet certain standards and that are not viewed in a holistic way and with respect to other efforts already underway in the state. So Representative Kahn supplied some language to address this issue that you'll see in B, starting in line 1.16 and going through 1.23. And I very much appreciate her comments in this area and her suggestion to do this and providing some specific language. My understanding from her is this is the kind of standard and approach that would have to be taken if, in fact, we were doing an appropriation for such a website development, and that we want to be consistent across all efforts by our state agencies, even if they're public-private partnerships, that they adhere to these standards and the Office of Enterprise Technology is involved and certain quality standards are met. And it certainly is the intent of DEED to meet these kinds of standards in going forward. Unfortunately, the folks at DEED that we worked with on this proposal, in particular Mike Myrie and his superiors, are all out of town today and were not reachable yesterday afternoon or as well. So they are not here to give their own personal perspective on this, but we would hope that they are minimal to this approach, given that we should be applying this across all areas of our state in terms of developing these kinds of initiatives. So those are the main three areas we discussed, and I welcome your feedback and your comments and questions.
Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Vaughn, I think the one thing that this bill is missing is the conflict of interest component to it. When you have the commissioner going out looking for private funds to support some kind of portal for business development, you don't want, say, a company that develops patents or helps people with patents, you know, being able to have their name splashed all over it in exchange for funding, et cetera. So I don't know if you've thought about that issue at all, but I think that you got to be really careful when you do these public-private interests. And private interests, if they're good, they're looking out for their own interest. And to the degree that the state or the taxpayers are participating or hosting a website for all users, I'm just concerned that if that issue isn't addressed up front, that some unintended consequences may be a result of asking for money and not having a clear policy going in about conflict of interest and what will and will not be accepted in a site.
And maybe, Madam Chair?
Just a sec. Maybe, Mr. Shepherd, could you come up with a clause that we could stick in that would make the...
Well, Madam Chair, I have been working... Representative Mariani was here earlier with a bill about the private funding for the poverty guideline impact fiscal note bill or whatever it was. And so we've been playing around with some language kind of in this realm for that bill as well. I don't think this is something that would be fair for Mark Shepherd. As good as he is.
We can't go through a meeting without him showing us how good he is doing these things. Okay, Representative
Kennedy. Well, Madam Chair, I was just going to make the comment that it would be a little bit, I agree with Representative Holberg, I think that it would be a little bit like an entity like TCF Bank, mm-hmm. For instance, wanting to, you know, put their name on something and then get twice or three times the value for what they contribute to it. So, you know, I think we should all observe those conflict of interest and the value propositions that are brought by doing
network,
so.
This network, you know, this network could maybe do as well as Google does. Of their ads on the network.
I doubt.
First of all, I didn't move the delete everything amendment, so I'll move the delete everything amendment now. And one of the things I think this is the only committee that, only part of any committee that shows any interest in information systems. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I would ask all members of this committee to be emissaries of on every other committee that you are. So you see, particularly as we're getting more of these private things, any time that you see some kind of a new network starting, particularly if it's not connected to government, to kind of make sure that we bring it under the aegis of OET, and we stop. And we just, the number you can all keep in mind is we have 36 separate data centers in the state. Our goal should be to get down to one. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a hard way to do it.
Well, Madam Chair, I have a comment in regards to the bill, but I think as far as, you know, there's two kind of philosophies. One is tear down the silos and merge it all into one. The other thing is put connections between the silos so that the data stays there and is secure, because often it's vulnerable when you switch it around to damage or loss. But if you make connector points to this data, it's a much cheaper way of doing things than moving that stuff around. So I just wanted to make...
I think the question is, you've got to do things on the way. One of the problems is the connective points, I think, become a real security problem in terms of... That means that any weak, secure... the other thing I recommend to all members of this division is to read the OET report if you want to... And if you want to not sleep nights, read the OET report on security.
Or if you can't sleep.
I have. Oh, Madam Chair, I have.
It depends. When I wake up, wake up in the middle of the night, alternating between worrying about what's happening in Haiti and worrying what's happening in OET security. I think I need a new life.
You and Representative Kalin maybe could share that. Yeah. I would say the question, though, Madam Chair, in regards to the bill in particular and the conflict of interest kind of concerns, I was wondering if and especially with DEED, because there are so many grants, so many things that have to do with business. But I don't know that it wouldn't be impossible to consider that OET be the one that deals with some of these VPNs or some of these sorts of things. I mean, gaining content or making those connections, I don't know that it's necessary for DEED to be the one developing, maintaining, and marketing. I think marketing might be something they might do, but the developing and the maintaining, just as a thought, and others who are here may have some experiences or other things, but I was thinking about that too, and what could be a possible solution other than just the conflict of interest, because I think they have so many indeed that's very difficult. If OET did the developing and the maintaining, they did the marketing, just a possibility of something to consider.
Well, one of the things we're doing is we're, you know, again, this is the question of, is it best to do it in the source or is it best to do it? And the direction kind of that we've taken is that we really need very serious oversight at the CIO office and so forth. But I don't know. Michael, do you want to?
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Michael Meilenberg, representing the Office of Enterprise Technology. Representative Kip Meyer, OET is always glad to be involved in the development of electronic government services. It is important to recognize, though, that state agencies are often involved in the development of their own websites, and we've, you know, had this discussion, or I've mentioned this a little bit before in regards to the state webmaster bill, that there is a significant number of agencies that do manage their own websites and have their own websites, and there is an aspect of IT that is at the agency level. And we recognize that the Department of Economic Development, Employment and Economic Development, has strong ties to this sector, and that it does make a lot of sense that they are in a lead role in regards to this because of their connections to this area, their work in this area, and it does make sense that they have a lead role. In regards to the amendment language, I think that that still provides an opportunity for OET to have input in this area and to provide some oversight in this area, and especially with regard to security, which obviously is a very important issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's very helpful. Thank you.
Representative Dunn. Yeah, Madam Chair, and hopefully I'm not repeating some of Representative Bunn's testimony, but I think Mr. Meyer adequately addressed the fact that OET, from just a core infrastructure and standards and policy, would be involved in this just by virtue of the nature of your organization with its role with DEED. But I just wanted to make a comment. There are numerous independent business-led efforts, the Minneapolis Regional Chamber of Commerce, other regional economic development authorities that have all tried their best to put up economic development portals, if you will. And I think there's a hue and cry from the business community that pulling all of those together and having a more consistent and coherent statewide portal to all of that would be the real goal here. Maybe I'm just repeating what you've already said, but the fact that an outside party would be paying for this, in theory, I think is a really good thing, and it's the right approach and strategy.
Representative Kahn, Madam Chair, and Representative Hall, I refer to Representative Holberg's original comment. I think it's a very good issue, and so I'll ask for your guidance on how best to address it moving forward. But to in terms of the history, currently the funding for this initiative, at least this phase one that's already been accomplished, has all been with foundation money from Minnesota. So to my knowledge, there's no necessarily direct business money involved, although there might be implicitly because it's a joint partnership with the, you know, with the chamber and the state. So they may have some in-kind and other resources on the table as part of this. But my understanding is the original foundation money, a portion of it went to DEED, a portion of it went to the chamber to support this effort, and they were going the foundation direction most likely again. But I think you're correct that it would be worthwhile to consider putting that kind of assurance language in, so if they branch out into a variety of areas, including private sector, just straight business contributions to this effort that those kinds of assurances about conflict are interested in. So, Madam Chair, I look to your guidance for how best between now and the next stop, or we, if we can't do it on the fly today, to address this with some additional language for the bill.
Okay. Mark, why am I the only one with total confidence?
Madam Chair and members, I do agree with Representative Holbrook. I think there are some policy questions here. This isn't just making them subject to a boilerplate conflict of interest mm-hmm. law, and I do think it would be best for the legislators involved to discuss this rather than
And Madam Chair, like you said, we've been working, we've been kicking some language around with Representative Mariani mm-hmm. around that poverty guideline donation thing that I think is a good and then framework to apply here.
And
as
then
well.
Maybe the next thing that's, or maybe not the next thing, but the thing that's going to, the biggest thing next that's going to come before us is our omnibus policy bill, where we get to put in all the things that Betzel took out of our omnibus appropriations bill. And so maybe one of the things you could think about is if we could get some nice general language that could go into that might be useful.
I'm sure there won't be anything controversial in that bill.
I'm sure what vehicle are you going to use?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
Pepin has a bill.
The same one. Got a couple of bills.
Denny Hecker is out of jail again.
Probably.
Oh, that's Tom Petters
with an anklet.
You could still hire him as a consultant around the state's Ponzi scheme. We need to adopt the Delete Everything Amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Okay, now renew my motion that,
Well, Madam Chair, I assume what we're implying then is that I know that you and also I really Representative Holbrook sit on the Finance Committee, that you're going to send it to Finance, and between now and then we'll work on having some amendment
language. Sometime. There are three more stops and whatever.
Yeah, we'll put this additional language on at that time.
Yeah. Okay. So now we'll move that Senate File 2758, as amended, be referred back to the full Finance Committee. Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you.
So.